and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for December 10th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the cloud climate feedback, how thinking about food reduces actual consumption, and fighting phishing fraud with DNA tests. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about getting fetal DNA from a mother's blood, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
One of the major uncertainties about global climate change is the effect of clouds, which can both reflect sunlight back out to space and hold heat in. Now, with 10 years of data from NASA's Ceres instrument, which measures both the solar-reflected and Earth-emitted radiation from the top of the atmosphere to the Earth's surface, researchers have data to compare with climate models to try to get a better handle on the effects of clouds. In a paper in this week's Science, Andrew Dessler reports his comparison of the data with climate models and concludes that clouds are not going to stabilize the climate and so will not counteract the water vapor and greenhouse gas emissions that are contributing to global climate change. I spoke with Dessler from his office at Texas A&M University.
Well, the first conclusion is that I've evaluated the cloud feedback and measured it using observations, and what I've shown is that it is likely positive, meaning that clouds are going to amplify the warming we get from carbon dioxide. And the second important conclusion is that if you then compare what I get from the observations to climate models, the climate models are actually doing quite a good job taken as a group. And that gives me confidence that the warming of several degrees Celsius predicted by climate models over the next century is probably right. I don't see any reason to doubt that.
So all the scientific climate change models out there, they all incorporate clouds, but the effects of increasing or decreasing amounts of cover based on climate change, the feedback from the clouds, that's been uncertain?
That's right. We've known what's in the models for a long time, but we really haven't had observations with which to test the models. And that's really, I think, the advance that my paper is. This is really the first time that we've been able to test the models in a really global average sense that includes all the clouds over the entire globe and really try to see if the models are doing a good job. And it looks like they are.
Before we get to the observations themselves, how does cloud feedback work?
Okay, well, clouds regulate the amount of energy that comes into the climate system. They do that by reflecting incoming solar radiation back to space, as well as trapping outgoing infrared radiation. So they control, to some extent, incoming and outgoing radiation. And so the cloud feedback posits a situation where you add some carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and that causes the climate to warm a bit. And that warming, though, changes clouds, and it changes clouds in such a way that the clouds let a little more energy into the climate system, and that causes even more warming. And that's, when we talk about the climate feedback, that's what we're talking about, how clouds amplify the warming you get directly from increases in greenhouse gas.
Is it only an amplification, or might it cut down on it, too?
Right. Well, obviously, you could imagine a scenario where clouds work to reduce the incoming radiation. In that case, you have what we call a negative cloud feedback, and clouds would be stabilizing the climate. That's not what my observations found, which is why I responded the way I did. But I will add that if you talk to the very small number of credible climate scientists who are also skeptical of the mainstream view, they all claim that clouds are what is going to stabilize the climate and prevent us from getting a lot of warming over the next 100 years. And I don't see any evidence that they're right.
Okay, so now then to those observations. What data did you use to estimate short-term cloud feedback?
Okay, well, I started with data from an instrument called Ceres that's flying on NASA's Terra satellite, and it measures energy in and energy out for the climate system. And then from that, I subtracted off effects of changes in water vapor and temperature and albedo and other things that can affect energy in and energy out. And what I was left with was the energy trapped by clouds. And so I was able to then look at how the energy trapped by clouds varies as the Earth warms and cools in response to El Niño and La Niña cycles. And again, what I found was that as the climate warms in response to an El Niño, clouds trap more energy, and therefore they're contributing to the warming, and we expect them then to amplify the warming from carbon dioxide.
Over what time frame was this data from?
Well, it's 10 years of data from when they turned the instrument on in March of 2000 to the last data they've analyzed, which is February of 2010. And so it's a short period, climatically speaking. And that's one of the reasons, it's probably the biggest single source of uncertainty in this analysis.
The cloud feedback.
That's right. In my estimation of the magnitude of the cloud feedback, the shortness of the data record is the primary source of uncertainty. If I had 100 years of data, I would be able to give you a much more precise estimate. I should add that there are lots of ways you could have done this analysis. There are sort of lots of arbitrary choices with exactly how you do the calculation of energy being trapped by clouds. And the key is that whatever choices you make in analyzing the data, you have to analyze the models exactly the same way. So everything I did to the data, I also did when I was analyzing the models. So it's really an apples-to-apples comparison between the observations and the models. And so someone else could come along and they could say, well, I'm going to analyze this a little different way. And that would be fine as long as you also analyze the models in exactly the same way. It's important for me to point out that what I analyzed here was the cloud feedback in response to short-term climate variations, these El Niño, La Niña cycles. And what we really want to measure as far as long-term climate change goes is the cloud feedback in response to long-term warming, which may or may not be the same as the cloud feedback in response to these short-term climate variations that I looked at. Unfortunately, it's going to be decades before we can make a direct measurement of the long-term cloud feedback. You need 50 or 100 years of data, and we just don't have that. And by the time we do have it, if climate change is as bad as it might be, that knowledge may not do us any good in 50 or 100 years. So what I've done by looking at these short-term cloud variations is the best we can do right now. But unfortunately, it doesn't necessarily tell us what the long-term effect of clouds is. That's one of the big caveats in my analysis.
So 100 years of data is what you'd really like. If we wait that long, climate change...
Yeah, your goose is cooked. The problem with waiting is carbon dioxide has a really long atmospheric lifetime, and the longer you wait to make a decision to reduce emissions, sort of the more committed warming that you've locked into the system. If you wait 100 years, you know, we're committed to several degrees of warming.
And your result also, it sounds like, meshes with the current long-term climate change models.
That's right. The feedback I get in response to short-term climate fluctuations is very similar to the climate feedback in response to long-term climate change. So it might be that the feedbacks are exactly the same, but I haven't really proven that in my paper.
It sounds like there might be a bit of a frustration then that NASA sent the satellite up to measure this kind of information, and with 10 years of data anyway, it doesn't seem like we're any closer to understanding the impact of clouds for long-term climate change.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think what we've been able to do is, for example, we can eliminate, I think, from this observation, we eliminate the idea that clouds are really going to stabilize the climate, which is what many climate skeptics are arguing. They're arguing that clouds are going to save our bacon from climate change by counteracting water vapor, all these other things. And I just don't see any evidence to support that, and I just think that's probably not correct. Now, what it doesn't do is it does not allow us to reduce the range of climate sensitivities that we now think. So right now, the range of climate sensitivity, if you read the IPCC, is 2 to 4.5 degrees Celsius for doubled carbon dioxide. This doesn't really allow us to reduce that range, but I think it does increase our confidence in that range. So it does help. But, you know, climate science is hard, and understanding clouds is tough, and, you know, there's always going to be the next problem on the horizon. I think the next thing to do is to really try to reduce that range. And I think climate science has done a remarkable job of really eliminating uncertainties. I mean, you read the IPCC from 20 years ago, and there were a lot of really legitimate uncertainties on things like water vapor and clouds and lots of things we didn't understand. And now we really understand almost all of those. I think my paper is sort of a step towards eliminating what really may be the last frontier of uncertainty in climate, which is clouds.
Andy Dessler, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Andy Dessler of Texas A&M University on his paper in this week's Science, A Determination of the Cloud Feedback from Climate Variations Over the Past Decade. When you sit down for a meal or have a snack, what stops you from continuing to eat? Is it that you feel full? Or is it that you kind of know when you've had enough to eat, a kind of habit of eating only so much, and so you stop before you feel full? And then the question is, what helps form that habit? Is it that you mentally construct an idea of how much is appropriate to eat? Or is it that your body experiences the smells, tastes, and textures of foods, and it's this exposure to these sensations over many meals and the occasional discomfort of overeating that helps build this habit? Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Carrie Morwidge and colleagues report the results of their experiments in which they separated out the thinking about food from the experience of eating it by having people just think about eating. The result? Imagined consumption reduces actual consumption, which suggests that to keep from eating too many chocolate candies, such as M&Ms, you might just imagine eating a bunch of them, one by one. I spoke with Morwidge from his office at Carnegie Mellon University.
Our findings show that repeatedly imagining the consumption of a food reduces its subsequent actual consumption because this imagined consumption reduces one's appetite for it or how much one wants to eat more of the food at that moment.
What if any research suggested the opposite, that people imagining eating food would, as a result, eat more?
Well, that's a great question, and I think there's sort of two lines of reasoning that would support the opposite. So most people have this lay intuition that imagining eating a food increases their desire for it and whets their appetite. So you might think, for example, that if you think about a steak, how it smells or tastes, that you'd have a stronger craving for that food and you'd have a desire to eat it. And we find that, yes, merely thinking of a food does increase our appetite for it. So if we just think about cues related to the food, or if we imagine doing something other than eating. But if we imagine consuming it, if we actually perform the mental imagery that would accompany its actual consumption, then imagined consumption actually decreases our desire for the food we imagine eating.
So not just imagining tasting, say, chocolate, but imagining eating a whole bar of chocolate like you might actually do.
Right. So we know from a long line of literature that there's a big overlap between mental imagery and perception. So, for example, if you imagine a spider crawling across your leg, you might see the same sort of elevation in heart rate, or people might show a fear response, or you might see different kinds of electrical conductivity in the skin that you would if you were in the actual presence of a spider as well. And so we were curious because previous findings had shown that people who are asked to imagine a particular experience in depth or elaborate on the experience, like imagine, for example, what a steak smelled like and tasted like and being exposed to a steak, showed a heightened response to that when you'd expect, based on sort of our response to other kinds of physiological stimuli, that it would diminish our response. And so what we find is that if you engage in sort of the mental representation of the experience of eating repeatedly, just as you would as a mental experience that would accompany actually eating the food, then we see this decrease in desire or appetite for the food.
And so what exactly did you have the participants in your study do or imagine?
Sure. Let me just walk you through one of the studies. So imagine you're a participant. What we would ask you to do is come into the laboratory, and then we'd ask you to imagine performing experience repeatedly. So, for example, some participants in our experiments were asked to imagine eating either 3 or 30 units of a food, such as M&Ms. So you'd imagine eating, for example, 30 M&Ms one at a time. Other participants imagine performing a different action, such as eating a different food or moving it rather than eating it. So in this case, you might be asked to imagine moving 30 M&Ms into a bowl. And then afterwards, we gave everyone a bowl filled with the target foods. You would be given a bowl filled with M&Ms, and we asked them to taste some of the M&Ms for an upcoming taste test. And so what we did afterwards was, unbeknownst to them, we measured secretly how much they ate while in preparation for that test. And then we found basically that only participants who imagined eating more of the food subsequently ate less of it from the bowl. So in other words, if you imagined eating 3 M&Ms rather than 30, you might eat more from the bowl. Whereas if you imagined eating 30, you'd eat less. But in the case where people imagine moving the food, you don't necessarily see this decrease in reduction. Or if people imagine performing a similarly effortful task, it's not necessarily reducing the amount they ate.
How do you know the results were due to the imagined consumption of the food?
Right. So one thing that we did do, well, we had a number of ways of testing that. So in the earlier experiments, we had people perform a similarly effortful control task. that involved motor actions. Like, for example, some participants were asked to imagine inserting quarters into a laundry machine, an equivalent number of quarters as the other participants imagined eating M&Ms. In other tasks, what we did probably most specifically address this question is we had people imagine eating the target food. So in this case, you'd imagine eating 3 or 30 M&Ms, or imagine eating a different food, for example, eating 3 or 30 cubes of cheese. And then afterwards, we present them with a target food and measure how much they ate. And so we found that only the imagined consumption of the target food rather than other foods reduced subsequent consumption. So in one experiment, we had participants imagine eating 3 or 30 cubes of cheese or 3 or 30 M&Ms, and then we give them a bowl of cheese. And only when participants imagined eating cheese did it affect their cheese consumption. So it doesn't seem like it's just simply the inductions making people feel either disgusted or full or feel like they've consumed a certain number of calories. It's really sort of a food-specific effect. And like other kinds of physiological habituation, this suggests to us that it's really inducing habituation or diminishing our appetite for the food rather than changing sort of the way that we're thinking about it or leading us simply to feel full afterwards.
And why is habituation the explanation here? I am capable. I can imagine eating 30 pieces of chocolate and each one tasting better than the last one, even though that might not be what happens in real life.
Right. So in real life, what we find is that people tend to show a diminished physiological and psychological response to stimulus after we've had repeated exposures. So for example, the 10th bite of pancake that you eat might sort of taste worse and be less appealing than the first. And so although sort of imagining, sort of thinking about pancakes extensively might lead you to crave them a little bit more, we find that sort of if you actually imagine the process of eating and chewing and swallowing the pancake, you find that the imagined consumption will have a similar effect on your desire for the stimulus and your responding to it as would actual consumption. And so we measure habituation in a number of ways. And the first is sort of this repetitive effect. So imagining the consumption more often leads to a reduction in the actual consumption. We find habituation is also stimulus specific. So if you give people, for example, a number of different foods and you ask them to eat a lot of one food, then you give them all those foods again, you only find a decrease in their consumption of the imagined food, not the other foods. And the last, we did an experiment where we had participants play a reinforcement game where they imagined eating 3 or 30 cubes of cheese, and then they had to click on a picture of cheese to earn points towards pieces of cheese at the end of the experiment that they could eat. And this is sort of a popular measure of measuring habituation in the animal and human literatures. And we found that people basically, they click less often when they imagine eating 30 cubes of cheese when they imagine consuming 3. So in other words, they work harder for cheese when they imagine consuming fewer cubes of cheese beforehand.
You said this was food specific, and it sounds like most, if not all, the experiments you had were related to food. What about drinking alcohol or other ways people perhaps consume too much? Does this same process occur there too?
Well, there's one reason why it might and one reason why it might not. So we don't know the answer to that yet. So one reason that it should be is that we find people tend to habituate to a variety of substances, everything from sort of the brightness of a light to their income. So we would expect that this kind of result that we've obtained in this sort of domain of eating should extend to these other kinds of domains, such as drinking or smoking or other kinds of similar processes. But we haven't really necessarily tested this with addictive substances yet. And so in the case of cigarette smoking or when alcohol is involved, as they do have some addictive properties, they might elicit a different response in this case. And this is certainly something that we're interested in following up. We've started to look at.
You said the participants didn't know that they were being measured in terms of how many pieces of chocolate or cheese that they ate. Does knowledge of what you're doing, the imagining of eating chocolate or cheese in order to eat less, still lead to less consumption?
You mean knowledge of that you're engaging in the action intentionally or just
yes.
Sort of? We're not really sure. We haven't asked people to intentionally reduce their consumption by doing this. We surreptitiously measured their consumption. But I don't see why, if we do engage in this sort of process intentionally, we would think that sort of given the overlap between mental imagery and perception, that we should still find this effect. So when people intentionally eat some kind of food, they do find there is a result that they tend to habituate to it. And so we would expect this to be the case, but we haven't necessarily tested that directly.
So a potential therapy then for people who overindulge in one way or another.
Right. I mean, in terms of the sort of therapeutic implications of this research, probably the most direct is that a lot of people tend to try to avoid eating unhealthy foods by suppressing their thoughts for them. And so that tends to be a flawed strategy because it suggests that basically you're going to stay at the initial state of craving, whereas our research suggests that repeatedly imagining the consumption of a food seems to decrease one's appetite for it. So they might actually be better off imagining consuming the foods that they crave rather than trying to suppress thoughts of them.
Carrie Morwidge, thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Carrie Morwidge of Carnegie Mellon University is lead author of a paper in this week's Science on how imagined consumption reduces actual consumption.
Illegal fishing costs anywhere up to $23 billion a year worldwide.
Science's Eric Stockstead reports in this week's issue on a new generation of genetic tests that could give authorities a much better idea exactly where fish are caught, and so cut down on fishing fraud.
Governments have been trying to fight this problem with a variety of techniques, everything from putting observers on the ships to see what kinds of fish are being caught and what size they are, to tracking larger fishing vessels by satellite. Another technique that's been used for quite a while is DNA testing to figure out what species of fish have been caught. But what they'd really like to be able to do is figure out what populations fish have come from, not just the species. Last month, I went to a conference on Madeira where a large group of European researchers were talking about their latest results in how to create easy, reliable, fast, and accurate tests that could identify which population fish have been caught from. And this could provide governments with perhaps an easy way to not only make sure that fish are being caught where they're supposed to, but that fish you buy in the supermarket actually are what they're labeled.
You said this DNA identification has been going on for some time. What are scientists trying to do to improve? Was it just a more expensive process or what?
There has been some work identifying fish by population. For strictly marine fish like cod, researchers have focused on genetic markers called microsatellites. These are repetitive units of DNA, and by studying where they occur, researchers can identify whether a cod came from the North Sea or the Baltic or Iceland or Nova Scotia. The trouble with using this for fisheries enforcement or anything where you want to do a lot of this kind of testing is that it's hard to calibrate between laboratories for various technical reasons. Looking at microsatellites isn't particularly an efficient way to identify a population, and it doesn't always work for all species or all populations. So there really was a need to try something that would be more efficient, faster, perhaps easier to use. In other words, what they want to do is take this from the lab and make it a tool that would really work. I don't want to say on the water, because it's not entirely clear that this is going to be something that an inspector is going to pull out of his hip pocket and stick into a fish on a boat, but something that really works for law enforcement purposes.
Right now, is DNA identification the kind that's going on in a lab any kind of deterrent for illegal fishing?
Yes, there have been success stories, and those have really shown what kind of an impact having a genetic test, even if it's just local to one laboratory, can have on a fishing community, the kind of deterrence that if the fishing community knows that they can be tested, that it really may change their behavior in terms of following the laws more closely. And in the story, I talk about one particular example from Denmark where microsatellite evidence was used in court and led to the prosecution of a fisherman who had caught some cod illegally.
So what's this new DNA identification test, not the microsatellites? What's being developed here?
The type of test that this research group is working on is based on a different kind of genetic marker. These are single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs. They're where, rather than a repetitive stretch of nucleotides, this is where one nucleotide in a DNA sequence has been changed. The advantage of looking at SNPs is that they're very common throughout the genome, so you have a better shot at finding a group of SNPs that are unique to a population.
And how many of these single nucleotide polymorphisms, these SNPs, are needed to distinguish fish from one population of a species from another population?
Ideally, as few as possible. And the reason is, if you're coming up with a test, the fewer SNPs that are being tested for, the cheaper and easier the test is to develop. So the researchers have shown, for example, that it's no problem to tell apart two populations of fish of the same species with hundreds of SNPs. They can get it down to a few dozen, sometimes fewer than a dozen, and still have up to 100% accuracy in identifying which particular population of fish came from. So the hope is that that will not only be able to provide solid courtroom evidence, but also to make the tests cheap and easy to produce and use.
I imagine that over time, these tests will need to be updated as fish continue to evolve. Several SNPs change with each generation?
You've hit on a key point there, Rob. And just to back up for a second, the reason, of course, it's easy to tell species apart is because they've evolved. They've acquired unique genetic characteristics, and populations don't have as many. You can still find them, but they're evolving. They're responding to their environment. So you want to make sure when you use this test that the population isn't evolving in a way that's going to make the test inaccurate. So what they're doing right now is going back and looking at historic samples of these species, cod, herring, hake, and sole, and looking at ones from 50 years ago to check whether the populations still have the same pattern of SNPs that they did 50 years ago. And on the flip side, they're using computer models to try and get a sense of how are those changes likely to happen in the future? How long will these tests still be accurate?
Where are these samples coming from?
Yes, in many places, fishery managers have been taking and storing tissue samples from fish. So these kinds of archives they can go into and check out the DNA and look back and see how the DNA has changed through time.
Is this just something that's going on in the fisheries and waters around Europe, or are there similar efforts to use DNA to fight illegal fishing happening elsewhere?
Most industrialized countries that are actively managing their fisheries have labs that can do these kinds of tests. So in the U.S., for example, NOAA has a marine forensics lab where they test samples. Not that long ago, they convicted a seafood importer of mislabeling catfish as much more expensive grouper. They've convicted importers of selling great white shark fins, which are protected. So this happens in a lot of places. Right now, it is fairly specialized. There are really very, very few places where genetic tests are a standard part of fisheries enforcement. So there are a fair number of examples where genetic tests are being used all around the world to identify species. It's very rare that populations are identified by genetic test. The key point is that fisheries are almost always managed not by species. You don't manage cod. You manage particular populations of cod. So you manage cod in the North Sea. You manage cod of the same species in the Baltic. You manage it around Iceland. So fisheries are managed by population. So being able to confirm that illegal fishing is happening in one population or another, or to be able to know exactly how much is happening, will really give fishery managers a leg up in making sure that these populations are either recovered or kept at a sustainable level. Same thing for consumers. You want to make sure that consumers are getting the fish that they think they're buying.
So as a result of this conference that you went to and this research that's been going on in identifying populations with DNA, when are we likely to see technology out there that's in use identifying these populations with SNPs?
Right now, the group is doing what's called validating their tests. And that means they're going back, making sure they're accurate to a level that would be useful for authorities and that could be used by any forensically certified lab. After that, they're going to be presenting these results to policymakers, other stakeholders in February. And after that, there really aren't any technical hurdles for making this into a test. What it becomes now is a cost-benefit question for regulatory agencies or companies or anyone who would be using these tests to try and help make some headway in the problem of illegal fishing.
Eric Stuckstead, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science's Eric Stuckstead reports in this week's issue on a new generation of genetic tests that could give authorities a much better idea exactly where fish are caught, and so cut down on fishing fraud. Finally today, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about getting fetal DNA from a mother's blood. How exactly does that work, Dave?
Well, Rob, researchers already knew that fetal DNA floats around in a mother's blood while she's pregnant, but it's in really small amounts. And researchers up until now have had a really hard time both isolating that DNA and also trying to distinguish that DNA from the mother's DNA, because as you can imagine, they're very similar. And so what doctors do now, if they want to try to figure out if a kid's going to have some sort of genetic abnormality, they do either a test called an amniocentesis, which they stick this very large needle basically into the woman's belly, take out some of the amniotic fluid, and then take the DNA from that. Or they also can do something called chorionic villus sampling, which sounds even more invasive. They basically pluck a snippet of tissue straight from the placenta. And as you can imagine, both of these techniques are fairly invasive, but they also have another downside, which they can slightly raise the chance of miscarriage. So even though we learn a lot from these techniques, they're not 100% safe. And so researchers have been saying, well, we know there's fetal DNA in the blood, and obviously taking blood is fairly uninvasive and very safe. Is there a way to use that fetal DNA instead of taking it via these other methods?
So a new technique then for separating the mother's DNA from the fetus's DNA based on just a withdrawal from the mother's blood.
Exactly. And really what the advance is here is the researchers here did much more powerful sequencing that had been done before. They used the most cutting edge sequencing technology, and they really sort of went to town on these mother's blood samples. And using this method, they were actually able to get a significant amount of fetal DNA, so much so that they knew that they had the entire fetal genome represented in the sample. And also there was enough DNA to allow them to very effectively distinguish between the fetus's DNA and the DNA of the mother and of the father.
So what's an example of something that they've found using this technique?
Well, Rob, in this study, they only actually have only tested this technique in one patient. So it's very early days. But what they did was they went to a mother who is carrying a genetic mutation for a disease called beta thalassemia. And this is a mutation that can lead to severe anemia. And interestingly, both the mother and the father had mutations, but neither of them had the disease. They were both carriers. But the problem is, if both your parents are carriers, there's a decent chance that you could actually wind up with the disease. And this is something that people would want to test for. And so the researchers applied their new technique, and sure enough, they were able to sequence the fetus's DNA. And fortunately, they found that the fetus also had this mutation, but the fetus only had the mutation on one gene. So the baby, turns out, is going to be a carrier as well, but will not have the disease. And they confirmed their method by going back and using one of these older methods, the chorionic villus sampling, which also confirmed that the baby was a carrier for this disease, but wouldn't actually have the disease. So even though this was with only one patient, they were able to show that the technique, at least in this one woman, was as effective as a much more invasive technique.
With the kind of coverage, full coverage of a fetus's DNA from sampling the mother's blood and going to town on it, as you say, it doesn't sound like this is going to be something that's going to be clinically available because of the expense.
That's true. It's still very early days. This technique is very expensive. Now, researchers expect the cost of sequencing techniques like this to really come down in the next few years. So as far as the cost issue, hopefully in a few years that will be resolved. But there are some other issues that experts bring up. One of them being, right now, even if you were to spend all this money, this technique returns so much data because you're dealing with basically the entire genome that it's more data than doctors know what to do with. And some experts are concerned that, yes, this will give us a lot of data, but will we really know what to do with this data? But experts say that if this does work out, and they do work out the kinks with this technique, and they do work out the cost issues, this could be really powerful, not only for diagnosing diseases like beta thalassemia that was done in this study, but also for other genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis and Tay-Sachs and other diseases. So theoretically, this is a very promising technique in a few years for determining the future health of your child.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from peeking into a fetus's DNA to learn more about its genetic code, to peeking into the complexities of whale communication, this next story is about how some whales mimic the calls of other whales.
Which whales in particular are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about killer whales, otherwise known as orcas. And these whales, like a lot of other cetaceans, which includes other whales and dolphins, have very complex forms of communication. They make a variety of sounds that seem to indicate that they're talking to each other. Of course, we obviously don't understand what they're saying or what these calls mean. But what researchers have noticed in some bottlenose dolphins, which are a relative of whales, is sometimes these dolphins will mimic the call of another dolphin. Just like a parrot might mimic something you would say, a dolphin would replicate a squeak or some other sort of noise from another dolphin. Now, that's just been seen in captivity. And this whole mimicking behavior is actually very rare in the animal kingdom. We know that some songbirds do it, and now we know that these dolphins do it, but only in captivity. But studying it in the wild, especially when you're talking about underwater in the wild, is very difficult. You've got all of these whales together, and they're making so many different noises, and it's hard to tell who's mimicking who because it's really hard to keep track of these whales. So this is something that's been very hard to study in the wild.
So these whales that this research team is studying are not in captivity.
They're not in captivity. They're actually killer whales that are found off the coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia. At least that's where the researchers studied them. And what the researchers did, because this is so hard, was they followed this pod of whales for a long time. And what happens is you have these groups of whales that sort of stick to their own group. So you have, say, one pod of whales, and sometimes they'll associate with other pods of whales, and sometimes they do that for mating or to build alliances, but then after a while they break off. So they followed this one pod of whales as it interacted with other whales. They did a lot of measurements of the whales' calls. They analyzed the calls with sonograms, which gives you really specific information that allows you to compare one call to another. And what they noticed was that one of the foreign pods of whales would make some calls, but when they left, the original pod of whales that the researchers were following seemed to sometimes mimic those exact sounds that the foreign whales had made. And a lot of times when mimicry has been seen in animals before, it's usually when the animals are right next to each other. So you're sitting next to me, Rob, and you say something.
Say something.
Exactly. Then you just mimicked me, but we're in the same room. But what was interesting in this situation is that the whales seemed to be mimicking these foreign whales after they left.
So kind of like I pick up a phrase that you might use a lot, like go to town.
Exactly. Like go to town. You might start using that. But it's not just the phrase you would be using the same. You would actually say it in the exact same way that I said it as well. And that's what researchers thought they were hearing here. And for example, here's what the foreign whale call sounded like. And now here's the mimicked call from the original group of whales. Foreign call. Mimic call. And you can hear they're not exactly the same, but they're very, very similar. And what the researchers found was that about one out of every 500 calls were mimicked calls, not necessarily that mimic call that we just played, but they were basically recreations of a variety of different types of calls that these foreign groups had made.
Is this helping researchers figure out what these calls might mean then?
Well, right now it's really just speculation. The first step was showing that the whales actually make these calls. But again, the interesting thing here is that they're making the calls, they're mimicking the calls in the absence of the other whales. So that could suggest a couple of things. It may be a way of referring to that group, or maybe it's a way to communicate something about that group's family members, you know. But this is really just speculation. The researchers know that the mimicking is happening. They're just not sure what it means.
Okay. So last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from a newly discovered type of mimicry to a newly discovered type of vision cell in the eyes, this last story is about a very rare type of cell in the eye which may help us see.
So not the rods and cones, but something else.
Exactly. For a long time, the dogma in the vision world has been the what are called the photoreceptors in the eyes that help us see are rods and cones. If you don't have rods and cones, or if there's something wrong with your rods and cones, then you're blind or near blind. And the rods and cones are the end-all be-all of vision. That's what's so interesting about this study. Researchers have found that a type of cell that's only been known about for about 10 years, which is called a melanopsin-containing retinal ganglion cells, or MRGC.
A neuron.
It's a type of neuron, but it's very rare in the eye. Only a very small fraction of the neurons in the eye are these types of cells. And even though they've been known for 10 years, they've never been linked to vision before. Researchers thought they had to do with our sort of reflexive responses to light. So if somebody shines a light really bright in your eyes, your pupils constrict. And the researchers thought these MRGCs were responsible for that, but they didn't think they had anything to do with our ability to see. Again, that was all chalked up to the rods and the cones. But in this new study, they show that these cells do seem to play some role in vision. They seem to allow us to see perhaps shadows and perhaps different shades of light. And the way the researchers found this was all done in mice. And they tried to find what these cells were connecting to in the mouse brain. And they found out that these cells were extending axons. These are sort of the stringy extensions that come off of neurons. These axons were poking into a part of the brain called the lateral geniculate nucleus. And basically, this is the part of the brain that is the relay station for visual information. So the researchers said, well, you know, if these guys aren't important for vision, why are they interacting with the vision center of the brain? That was the first thing. But then they took mice that were genetically engineered to not have rods and cones. So these mice should have been blind, but these mice still had the MRGCs. And what they found was that when they shined varying intensities of light on the mice, when the light was very intense, like daylight, this part of the brain, the lateral geniculate nucleus, became very active as if it was processing visual information, even though these mice theoretically shouldn't have been able to see because they didn't have rods and cones.
So they help with sensing variations in brightness.
That's what the researchers think. They say it might be something like you and me being able to distinguish between a dark wall and a brightly lit doorway. So these are not subtle cues. They would have to be very broad types of visual cues, like something very bright or something very dark. But that is still a type of vision. And what's important about this paper is it's saying that's a type of vision that we apparently don't need our rods and cones for. There's this third type of neuron in the eye that's giving us that ability.
Does this suggest a potential target then for therapy for people who are blind and helping to restore sight?
Well, that's a great question. And a lot of blind people have problems with their rods and cones. But these researchers say, well, if they don't have their rods and cones or they have problems with their rods and cones, but their MRGCs are still intact, then maybe that's something scientists could target. And probably wouldn't give these people vision, but even being able to distinguish light and dark could go a long way in helping these people better adapt to the world they live in. But that's speculation at this point. The researchers don't yet know, first of all, whether these cells perform the same function in humans, and if so, what sort of therapies they could design based upon these cells. It's just promising research at this point.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got another whale story, this one about how whales feed themselves, especially blue whales, which are the largest animal on Earth. They expend a lot of energy trying to get food. And this story is about how do they make up for all that energy they expend. And also a story about whistling caterpillars. And for Science Insider Science's policy blog, we've got a story about an annual international test that tests science and math abilities for countries all over the world. And you can find out where your country ranks by checking out this story. And also about a new institute that's being created at NIH that will help the government agency spur the development of drugs and medicine from basic research. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the December 10th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.